Hi, this is Katie Day, and welcome to Creating Ripples, the programme that showcases inspirational women across the globe. Sometimes it is the small acts and achievements that can create the biggest ripples. We're here to share some amazing stories. They will make you laugh. Sometimes they may make you cry. They will always inspire you. Today it is my absolute pleasure to be interviewing Baroness Udine. Manzilla Udine is a British life peer and community activist of Bangladeshi descent. She is the first Muslim and second Asian woman to sit in the Parliament of the UK. Manzilla Udine moved with her parents to the UK in 1973 when she was 13, and she grew up in the East End of London. She started her professional career by creating and leading community working groups in the late 1970s. She was invited to the House of Lords for her contribution to the advancement of women and disability rights. She has received a national and international reputation as a leader in promoting women's equal rights, including human rights, in Britain and abroad. Manzilla Udine has been long campaigning for the increase in the participation of women in civic life. With a group of friends, she founded the first purpose-built education and training centre for Asian women in the UK in 1999. In 2005, she was selected by Tony Blair to be part of a committee to address the issues of radicalisation of young people. In 2009, she was nominated for the shortlist of Female Peer of the Year at the Women in Public Life Awards. She chaired several government task forces. Thank you, Manzilla.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much for being interviewed. It's an absolute pleasure. We've met a few times. I first met you at a really, really interesting talk at the House of Lords about 18 months ago. I noticed that we were born in the same year, so we're the same age. 1959 was clearly a very, very good year for
women. And we're doing very well.
Bless you.
Yes.
So you arrived, because I can remember what I was doing in 1973 at the age of 13, but then I was born in the UK. What was it like to arrive in the early 1970s as a 13-year-old? It must have been quite a shock to the system.
I think definitely that's a really good way to start. London was reputably held in high esteem in places like Bangladesh and our region anyway, especially for providing good education,
right.
Good economic conditions for migrants, and generally, I mean, it's a place where my father was already here. He'd lived here.
Oh, was he?
Yeah,
right.
He'd lived here since early 60s.
Okay.
So he came to do law in this country, and he stayed. And we obviously stayed back with our five brothers and sisters, and my mother was a teacher, I do not believe that we would have arrived here to live here if the war between Pakistan and Bangladesh hadn't happened. And obviously it was a devastating war. Thank God Pakistan didn't have a nuclear weapon or the kind of weapon now that we're carpet bombing or any of that. Maybe many, many, many more of us would have been slaughtered. Bangladesh war meant that millions died. Millions, I think 10 million were replaced and flew to India. And apparently, there's no official estimate, but maybe about 300,000 to 400,000 women were raped by Pakistani army. So I think it's right to say that although I was very young, I was very much mature and in my thinking. I think I don't like to use the word political, but I think I was very much already a kind of activist, because my family were all supporter of an independent nation of Bangladesh. My mom's side of the family, they're all teachers. So we were very kind of active. My family were very active in the war. We lost two of our cousins who went to war. We lived with my grandfather and my grandmother. And because they were both very old, you know, my mom needed to look after them and us. So I think we survived for whatever reason we did, and we arrived here from this, you know, very large family of loving, supported, extended family and a huge house, open field, living by the river, everything that any child, well, I would have wanted, I would have loved to have given my children that kind of upbringing, despite the war. I mean, you know, that's a different perspective, but the kind of childhood I had, I would have liked to have given. And I think, I don't know that we actually expected that we would arrive and have the same condition. I don't think we had any preconceived ideas at all. But we arrived here on a very, very grey day. I think either 1st of January or just thereafter, something like that.
1970s London.
Oh my God.
So, so different.
I know, I just remember this fog, I can tell you that. And I think my father had arrived in the airport. I don't know whether he borrowed somebody's coat or something. It was like huge, so that we wouldn't die a death of cold on our, you know, first minute into England. And then we went to stay with a friend of my father. He had arranged this room just near Plashett School, as a Plashett Park. And we stayed in this very, very small, dingy, desperate, desperate room, all of us. And it was very difficult, I think. So the memory of very early on, the perception of London, really not to be pondered on too long, too much painful memory. But I think the, you know, the further saving graces were that, you know, we lived just by this park. And we subsequently bought, my father bought a house just not too far away from the park. So the park, and then right next to the park was a library. And then, of course, you know, within 6 months, once I had some grasp, some English, went to Plashett myself, which was a grammar school for girls, but entered the den once more. Straight into GCSE.
Well, I'm going to say you arrived at the age of 13, not speaking the language, to somewhere that was grey and cold and, in comparison to where you'd come from, quite dismal. And also with the vibe of the 1970s in England, particularly in London, wasn't very supportive of people who weren't white and British.
Yes.
So that was an awful lot to contend with as a 13-year-old.
I would think, well, I have two thoughts about that. One is that it was very evident that not many of us were welcomed. Definitely, I can't remember very many signs of saying that we were welcomed. There was a tiny shop where we could get some remotely looking Asian foods, run by a Pakistani man, whom we got to know very quickly. And then we lived with this Asian family. You know, the auntie became my mother's best friend, and older daughter and I, we remain friends still to this day, and my brothers and sisters became friends to their younger siblings. So we created, I suppose, in a way, in a desperate situation, a little group of people that could begin to sort of develop some extended, you know, some sense of extended family. And the other thing was obviously the schooling, and it was very difficult. I mean, my father was a very strict person. I mean, I had a lot of really difficult relationship with my father. My mother had divorced him very soon after we got here.
Oh, right.
So it was a, you know, very, very difficult time, and I kind of resented the fact that I had to come here anyway, leave everything behind. I was a really bright student. And then I end up in a school where most of the teachers thought, because I didn't have that command of English, that I was really thick. And I think once you call someone thick enough times, although you could be the most brilliant scientist or whatever, I mean, I was really brilliant in maths and science, and everybody had said I'd become a doctor much earlier than I was expected. And I would have, I think. And well, destiny means that I didn't. And then I ended up in a school where I had really, I was tortured by some of my school teachers for not speaking English, and really just dumped to say, well, she's not going to do very well anyway. And I only ended up there because it was my, you know, the school literally next to where we were staying. So, but really, again, I was so fortunate to have, well, I was blessed by my English teacher. I mean, she rescued me out of my darkest time, I think, and made sure that, you know, she said, even now she says, you know, oh, that little, you know, light in your eyes is still there, kind of stuff. Like she say, you know, what are you doing? You just need that one person to believe in you, don't you? I always have said that to my children. I have five children. And in fact, my career teacher, even at the time when my English teacher, Nicole Frenny, I love, I adore, and to this day I keep in touch with her. And she, I think she was the reason that I survived school and got out with some respectable grades. I mean, I've got 8, maybe even 10. Sciences weren't that good, but I think I've got O-levels, and I went in to study English history and biology in my A-level, so which I didn't complete. And the career teachers, I mean, they were just like kind of, you know, it was like you couldn't move. There was so much barriers. There was so much prejudice.
But also the life for women was very different then. You know, we were at school, you know, our school life was in parallel. And I can remember having the careers talks when I was a teenager at school, you know, 15, 16. And it didn't actually occur to any of our teachers. I went to an all-girls grammar school to suggest university. It was, what can you do to fill the time before you get married and have children? You know, that was it. So it's teacher, nurse, I think teacher or nurse or secretary was what was on offer.
I did do shorthand and typing.
Yeah, me too.
She made me do shorthand and
Jolly
typing.
Handy,
career teacher, actually. I can't remember her name, thank God. I mean, I would probably go and hound her and try and find her. But anyway, I did go back to my school, Plashett School, a couple of times. And I did say this to the young people when I was speaking, and I said it to the teachers who kind of worked there, that, you know, aspiration, there was no assumption on the fact that underneath this, you know, immigrant, you know, unwanted immigrant girl, Asian, Muslim, you know, it was like all the worst crimes you could commit as a human being to being born in that state, that there might be something about, you know, your own potential, no matter how little it was. Because she said to me, I remember, look, you know, it just abide your time. You're just going to be a machinist the rest of your life. And you're going to have, she said to me, you're going to have 5 kids. And you probably get married at the age of, you know, 16. And, you know, I mean, I have to say to her, if I ever met her, that I did. I mean, I did get married. I did have 5 kids, exactly. But, you know, I went back to university at the age of, I don't know, 28, 30, whatever it was, you know, after my third kid. So, I mean, the love for education, which was embedded in every ounce of my skin, bones, blood, veins, you know, instilled by my, you know, father's father, my grandfather, Dada, and my mom's family. It just stayed with me. It's still with me. I still think I want to get a master's, I want to get a PhD, you know, like I'm not good enough until I do that. And I'll probably die before I have got the opportunity. But nonetheless, you know, this ambition, it stayed with me, really.
Do you think your experiences of arriving here as a 13-year-old girl into a completely different world and not speaking the language has provided you with some of that fire in your belly that has projected you through life, or do you think that was there anyway?
No, I definitely know that it came from my family and the love that I had. I mean, I was adored, you know, by my grandfather. I had amazing, he was an amazing man. He, you know, during the wartime and before that, when we were living together, I mean, he educated, he was person who didn't have education. He got married early, he set up business early, but he educated all his girls and boys equally. So did my mum's dad, he was a lawyer. All of them, including my mum, they're all teachers of, you know, university, college, school students. So, no, I think it was in my system, in everything that we did. And I think the kind of eagerness to just, you know, manage and survive the next day comes from my experience, I think, of, you know, everything to do with my family and and also experience of war, because I think it gives you, instills in you the very instinct of survival, you know, and that, and looking towards the future, and there must always be something better, and then anything you do can make a difference, no matter how little it is. Yeah. I think it was very much instilled, and I think that's why, I think that's the reason why I kind of became involved in sort of community activism in and around Brick Lane and Town Hamlet and all that in the early days. I had always been very, you know, vocal. I can just remember, I mean, in school, you know, learning English was just like kind of almost like a side thing, sidestep. Nicole, you know, sort of introduced this whole idea of us running a magazine. I used to sort of, you know, do the magazine. I used to write poetries.
Oh, gosh.
And then...
was that a school magazine?
Yeah. We instigated this magazine called Litsok when we were in fifth form, I think.
Gosh.
And in fact, Lynn Brown, who's a member of parliament, she and I were on... in the same school and then in same Litsok, yeah. And we've ended up, and obviously we remain friends too. And so it's, I know, it's a very, very small world. And I remember the one of the tensions where in schools, in those very, very early days of entering school, is a tension between the African Caribbean girls and the small pockets of Asian girls, because they would always collude with the white students to bully the, you know, Asian girls. And I think I was the most vocal and really, I mean, resistant to any notion that, I mean, we just like kind of beat Pakistan and I'm not going to have any bullying by anybody else. You know, like, it was so embedded in me. And I was the only Bangladeshi person. There were only, of course, my sister later joined and another young girl from, she was in a different form, but there were Indian and Pakistani girls, and I just felt it was like kind of my obligation, you know, to kind of stand up, and we did, together we did stand up, and I don't think we suffered bullying because of, you know, the kind of being able to resist being bullied. And I think that is also very much ingrained from that war experience. And similarly in community, you know, just not lying down and taking a ghetto, not lying down and taking a beating on, you know, resisting institutional racism or institutional poor practice, always striving to do better. Not that, you know, my life's example sort of demonstrates that I have achieved personally anything great. I don't consider being in the Lords anything significant. In my life, I just take it like it was a stage, like it's a place, it's an office where I've served from. It's in my heart, from where I say this, that I've never looked at it as a place of, you know, importance. I don't look at myself like that. And so, like, when I was in running various organizations, I saw it as doing something for greater good of all of us. So when I was on a housing association, we formulated a housing co-op, for instance, I thought it was for better housing, not, although I did end up being a co-op housing tenant, but that was years and years and years later because I believed in that principle.
Okay.
So, but we created that, you know, so it was about better education, if it was about better healthcare, and I remember when I was very, very early on in the 80s, I think, I don't know, 81, whatever. I was working with the YWCA, a project called Avenues Unlimited, and I replaced someone called very, very much loved Caroline Adams as a one of their first, you know, women workers, youth and community workers. And we found out that there were problems in London Hospital providing healthcare. And some women were having virginity tests. And so, you know, like...
Goodness.
I mean, if you think about it, it wasn't, you know, centuries ago, but it happened to... There are some very specific experience which, you know, were succumbed in racism and racist practice and institutionalized practice simply because I think people thought that they could get away with racism. And others were purely ignorant, and they were so much steeped in stereotypes. And we campaigned, you know, we said that we weren't going to tolerate it. We, you know, and eventually we did stop it. And so I think that, I mean, you just think now that education in Tower Hamlet, in particularly girls, are doing, my God, you know, they're doing as good as anywhere else in the country. But believe me, when we walked in into those institutions, it wasn't like that. And it's really dedicated graft work for many of our people, in many of my generation, that meant that we have the place that we have now, which we call home.
And it is about fulfilling the legacy of our ancestors, isn't it? You know, when I think what I do now, that I take for granted without even a second thought, wasn't even on the radar screen for my mother.
Yes.
In one generation, how different my life is to hers.
Yes.
And for me not to continue to promote the lives of women and to try and make it better is disrespecting the hard work that my ancestors did. You know, as women, it is about us standing together and honouring our ancestors and creating a clearer path for the women who are coming up behind us.
I think you're absolutely right. The added dimension for women like us who were, you know, migrating into a new nation, new country, new home, the added dimension is, well, I already had a legacy of my mum's generation. She'd left behind a generation of, you know, women who are not educated, but then fulfill the dreams of her parents. And there we were, we came here without any acknowledgement that we had that legacy. So like we have to start all over new to not only pay respect and homage to the experience and the legacy and the contribution and the skills and talents of our parents, but also create a new generation or new movement, new environment, so that we could leave a legacy for our kids. So I think that I would say that that's the added dimension, but you're absolutely right.
You know, I get really annoyed with women who don't vote.
Oh my God,
because
so do I.
So disrespectful to, you know, Emmeline Pankhurst did not tie herself to the railings. You know, just think of what those women fought for and went through.
You know, very interestingly, right, Nicole made me do an essay. She when I could hardly speak a word of English, I could read them, but it really didn't make any sense. She gave me, you know, tons of books. So you know, all the classics I read, and she said to me, "Okay, go and do a," because I was so engrossed in women's rights. I always used to argue, like, you know, sort of against the grain. I would say, well, actually, no, it's not like this for me in my community, or it's not like, don't say that. My mom's a teacher, or actually my aunt is the first banker, you know, in Bangla, woman banker, or my aunt is the first women's professor, women's principal in a women's college in Bangladesh. So I would say things like that, you know, so I'd always kind of be, so she said, go and do a project on the suffragettes. And that was one of my first essay compilation on suffragettes. I think somewhere in my garage still lies the you know, that project.
You still got it?
I think I have somewhere. I've shown it to my kids when they were younger, but I haven't been able to locate it for the past like 5-6 years. But they to me sort of indicate that, you know, for me there's been a pattern of consistency about the things that I've always believed in. Mm. I haven't shifted from there. And maybe that's kind of like slightly not progressive in sometime. Maybe I think I haven't progressed enough. You know, I haven't kind of moved on and say, okay, now I'll do something else. I keep coming back to this notion, this idea of, you know, sort of injustice, and that we have to do something about it, prejudice, you know, countering. I mean, I'm really upset with the fact that 68% or 65% of all Pakistani and Bangladeshi women are out of the economic zone in this country. We are living in the UK. This is 2016. And we are talking about empowerment of women, and we haven't got there. We don't get it. Because and even then, there is exclusivity, you know, that we have left these massive parts of our communities in the margin, and we think there's no consequences. And then we ask for rationale for why there are problems in our societies, or why there are, you know, why aren't the girls, you know, sort of achieving in science, or why aren't they sitting running companies? Of course, because we have a legacy of failures. So I feel rather challenged by the fact constantly that there has to be things done.
And it's the hidden exclusivity that's carrying on, isn't it?
Yeah, because I think in a place where you and I are sitting, it works by people you know, and the position that they have, and they're measured. Mm. Like if you ask many of my colleagues to reel out a whole list of what they've done, their office, you can see the ones who've succeeded are in a category of white male and then white female.
Okay.
And then they have a strata of, sort of, they belong to a strata of societies. And people like myself are excluded from that. So I've been here 17 years. You know, I don't think I would have ever been asked to, or regarded maybe as capable of contributing something to develop the economy. But I would have been asked to develop the economy of minority women, as though there is a specific set of ghetto from where we're not allowed to exit. Mm. So I think that society as a whole is extremely, extremely narrow, and there's, you know, there are silos in which we live. And I would think that that's one of my great frustration.
So continued frustration. What is life like today for you?
I would say that I'm very reflective about that. I have to think about that all the time, because I, you know, I'm in my past mid-50s. I'm going to be 57. So I actually think that if I was very honest, then I think because of global crisis, not just here, but everywhere, and we've been lucky to have shaded ourselves from many of the global events. For many, we hold some significant responsibility. Middle East is in utter chaos and crisis because of many of the decisions we concurred with America, and our legacy of leaving what's happening continuously in the conflict of, you know, Palestine-Israel situation and all that has unfolded. I would say that the hope that I had, and many of my friends say they don't feel that hope, that they're going to have a certainty of a secure prejudice-free future for our kids that they have. When we wanted to change things, I think maybe a little bit of too much optimism, but we felt that we were able to really see things change, and you know, we took pride in those changes that we were able to secure in a place which wasn't our natural home environment. There is continuous gratitude, particularly of, you know, Pakistani, Indian, Bangladeshi, but I think all migrants, gratitude about England or America if they ended up in America, and the new homes, especially of people like people from our generation. But this is, you know, sort of battling against constant reminder that we are a stranger. And now, of course, you know, this demarcation about Islam and the identity of Muslim is a really difficult one. We've all been taught, if there's real honesty, we've all been taught with the same brush. There is, you know, there is not enough intelligent consideration given to the fact that there's a handful of people that are extreme, that are a handful of people. Yeah. It's like saying, you know, because I was a child protection officer for my social work life. And when you are immersed in protecting children, you do think that everybody's walking around you is a potential pedophile. Yeah. And so maybe we are so consumed by what we see that we think every Muslim, you know, person is one we cannot trust. So imagine that level of scrutiny. I fear for the lives of my grandsons. I have three of them, 8, 5, and 4. And I have a granddaughter. I think in some way, women from our faith, culture, backgrounds have a better chance of succeeding, because sometimes we are patronized, you know, like there's sorriness about these girls must be so oppressed, you know, unless they were sort of with verbal diarrhea like I was, you know, like I never gave anyone chances to feel sorry for me. In fact, they thought, you know, what kind of creature is this, you know, coming from and looking like that, and then arguing back with us, how dare she, kind of stuff. But those who are kind of, you know, quiet, and they can have a really good, solid, probably future, and they will go through the education system and they'll probably have jobs or whatever. But I fear for our grandsons. And in fact, I live with my examples. Mm. I can't think in a place like House of Lords in absentia of my existence. Mm. And I think that's what I try and bring to the house. I don't bring any expertise. I'm not world expertise or anything. House of Lords constantly say that, you know, we are full of experts. And I think, oh, I'm not really. But I can only bring, because I'm very outspoken. I think I'm an extremely brave person to have survived the House of Lords and its various stages that I've gone through with the House of Lords. And so I've just been very open with myself and with the House, and I raise these things. And at the moment I'm chairing something, again, we're back to a little bit of ghetto work, but I hope that it will result in something more positive and feed into the discussion. I'm chairing something called Commission on Muslim Women, and because I wanted to gauge where we were, because we're so categorized as either Muslim or not. You know, we are not allowed to have just the label of being a woman or just being a member of the House of Lords or a member of a bar association or a doctor. We are labeled Muslim before anything else. So I thought, okay, well, I want to know where those amazing women that I know exist and that are contributing to this society from every angle, every profession, where they are, what they're doing. but also to look at some of the difficult issues. So for instance, we've had a really good debate on what the Prime Minister said, very wrongly, that, you know, not speaking English will in some way impact, you know, or assist radicalization. Yep. It's a very unintelligent comment to make. You know, I think he was being very flippant and very irresponsible. So we debated that in the House. But before I debated in the House, I gathered the women, a group of women, women's organizations, as well as some, you know, key individuals who are amazing in their own right. And I asked their opinion. So then I took it to the House. And so we also have had a discussion on the impact. Sharia Council is an issue in the House.
Yeah.
It's been brought singularly by Baroness Cox. I fundamentally disagree with her premise that Islam is fundamentally you know, divisive in that way and unfair to women. I've never believed that. So I want to bring that discussion. We had a really great debate with her, and we're going to address the issue of prevent and the impact and on particularly families. So I want to bring this and then put it up to the ministers for her, their consideration, and see whether we can promote some of the really good work that's going on, some of the positive women that are around, so that, you know, we can highlight their achievements. So
it's crucial that that happens, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. To counter some of, really provide some balance. Provide the balance, so that when members of parliament or ministers or people who are making decisions, they can see that it's not just, you know, one narrative, one silo of narrative, but that there is a, it's a community that are fundamentally British. You know, whatever the issues we have in Britain, whatever the issues there are in America, where I come from, I went there twice in 2 months, essentially American, and here we are addressing what is fundamentally British.
I would love to interview you again just on what does it mean to be British.
Oh my God. Here we are. I think everything that you see
so
is what
complex,
it is.
Isn't it?
I think British, yeah. I think we have a new Britain.
We do.
And I hope that we're going to embrace it in the EU, please. I think this, I'm in person. So.
Are you?
Oh, yeah. Definitely, yeah.
That's another interview. Yeah. You've already got two more lined up.
I've been trying to say to all my friends, and I agree with you completely, I am absolutely radical about voting. I pester everyone I know to vote.
Yeah, it's essential.
We critical.
Absolutely have.
Yeah.
It is.
So,
just one final comment. Do you think it should be against the law not to vote?
I would love to see that, actually. Yeah, not
some countries it is.
I know, as Australia. I don't like the punishment. I don't like these fine things. But I think it should be mandatory to vote, just like it's mandatory to do countless other activities, you know.
Interesting.
If it's, you can't get married, you know, if you're 18, for instance. I'd like to see us having a law saying you can't get married unless you're 18, and then You have to, if you're a citizen, you have to vote. Yes, I'd love to see that.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one.
Great.
I think it should be mandatory.
Yeah, shake hands on it.
That's a perfect way to end. Thank you very much. You've been listening to Katie Day with Creating Ripples. Listen in and be part of the revolution that is rocking the world. Women over 50 are the new future. We are awesome, fearless, fabulous, inspiring, passionate, courageous. In fact, we just rock.
Wow.